Please, it is necessary to consume electricity sparingly in all regions, as before. If you don't have a power outage, it doesn't mean the problem is over. Please, if you have electricity, this does not mean that you can turn on several powerful electrical appliances at once.
That's Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky speaking earlier this week, pleading with his people to conserve electricity. A barrage of Russian missile attacks has caused widespread power outages across Ukraine, including in the capital city, Kyiv. That's left 6 million Ukrainians without heat, electricity, and water just as the coldest months arrive. People often wait in line for hours for fuel and clean water. Barbers are using lights on their smartphones to cut hair in some instances. Even surgeons have been forced to operate under flashlight. Here to talk about how the country is coping is Matthew Luxmore. He's a reporter for The Wall Street Journal in Kyiv covering the war. Hello.
Hi there.
Well, speaking of doctors, you wrote about a cardiac surgeon who was in the middle of installing an artificial heart valve in a 14-year-old when he heard blasts and the lights went out. What did he do?
I mean, it was a pretty desperate situation, but it wasn't something that the hospital was completely surprised by. I mean, obviously they had had these blackouts before, so they had some backup generators that were ready to go. The main danger there is that obviously it takes a few minutes for these backup generators to get started. And obviously, if you're operating on someone with a congenital heart condition, stopping the operation is potentially fatal. So it was in that particular situation, it was a very, very dangerous thing to do, but they didn't really have a choice.
And did they whip out their smartphones and use the light?
Not their smartphones, but they did have LED lamps that a couple of the staff were holding up while the doctors kept operating. And in a video that the doctor, the head of the clinic, Boris Todorov, posted to social media, which really went viral about a week ago after the operation took place, you can hear him shouting to his staff, you know, get this done as soon as you can. You know, let's get this finished up, because I think he was very aware of the fact that, you know, these generators can't run forever, and mm-hmm. they may be completely out of power and then lose the life of this young boy.
Oh, wow. And so in general, what is it like in Kyiv? Millions of people live there and they are coping with this very unreliable grid. What's happening? What's it like to live there?
I mean, it's quite incredible, to be honest, because, you know, you're living in a major European city of several million people, which is almost entirely plunged into darkness. I mean, I don't want to exaggerate the point. You know, there are lots of cars driving around. And the situation today, for instance, is much better than it was a week ago after the latest massive barrage from Russia. But, you know, people are walking around the streets using their smartphones to light the way. In my apartment building, which is kind of a very old building, we have a staircase, I think, from the Tsarist era. And when the lights are out, you really feel like you're in some kind of World War II movie, or like you've literally been taken back, you know, 150 years in time, because it's completely dark. You know, you have these incredibly old stairs and banisters. And, you know, every so often you walk past someone like this dark shadow on the staircase. Mm. So it really feels in times like you've been thrown back in time.
Yeah, really scary and creepy. I'm wondering if there's some looting and other crime associated with that happening now.
I've not seen any reports of any wide scale looting or anything like this. You really do sense this kind of atmosphere of solidarity. People are kind of clubbing together. And actually, when there's no power and light and no water, as there was last week, it kind of forces people to stay together and rely on each other a lot more. So I think it's actually drawn a lot of people together, and maybe neighbors who never spoke to each other before are now lending each other lamps and other things. So I think it's quite the opposite is happening based on my experience.
There's also what the president has spoken about, these invincibility centers, and these are basically power and heating centers in Kyiv and throughout the country. Tell us how those work.
Yeah, they're small tents that people can go into. I was in the one in Kherson, which is the city that was recently liberated. that actually was one of the first cities that had a complete power water outage. And they had this big tent in the central square, a few tables on either side with extension cords. People could just plug their phones in. It runs on a couple of generators, and there's a couple of heaters in there. So there's around 5,000 of them in the country now, according to the government. And there's a very big push to have these up and running in as many places as possible, as soon as possible, because the temperatures are going to be dropping and it's going to get harder and harder for people.
Yeah. So you mentioned Kherson. This is, as you said, the city that was liberated. It was in Russia's control until earlier this month. And then Ukrainian forces successfully ran the Russian troops out. But is this now Russia's strategy to wage war, I guess, from afar by targeting infrastructure points and hoping to really make life so unbearable that Ukrainians will give up?
I guess there's kind of two dimensions to the war right now. One is the kind of military dimension, which is obviously the military campaign on the ground, where Russia's essentially ground to a halt. I mean, it has had no significant victories since the summer. And Ukraine, as we've seen, has managed to retake a lot of territory and put Russia very much on the back foot. So these missile strikes and earlier the drone strikes against Ukrainian infrastructure and also some civilian objects is kind of the second dimension to the war, where Russia is trying to, I think, sap Ukrainians' morale and perhaps pressure the government to come to the negotiating table. But we're not seeing any evidence in Ukraine that this strategy is bringing the kind of results that Russia may want it to bring.
Meanwhile, here in the United States, the Biden administration pledged $53 million to help rebuild the infrastructure in Ukraine. But if the grid is repaired soon, could it not just be attacked and bombed again by the Russians?
Yeah, I think what we're seeing is the blackouts, the outages in Ukraine are getting worse and worse and worse over time. And each time that Russia has barraged the country with missiles, the blackouts have been longer and they've been more intense, in the sense that initially maybe your power went out, then the second time it went out for twice as long, and the third time, as was the case last week in Kyiv as well, the power and the water went out and the phone signal. So it's a constant effort, I think, a constant calculation about how you can route this power to homes, to the largest amount of homes. But I mean, I think just on a basic level, the more that Russia strikes this infrastructure with missiles, the worse it's going to get, because it's going to take a lot of time to set up new infrastructure, I think, and connect it to the grid.
That's Wall Street Journal reporter Matthew Luxmore reporting from Kyiv in Ukraine. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Sure. Thank you very much.
In China, government officials are signaling the country may start moving away from its strict zero COVID policy. Earlier this week, China's most senior COVID response official said the country is entering a, quote, new stage and mission when it comes to pandemic controls, though she didn't give specifics. And this comes as the biggest protests since the 1989 pro-democracy Tiananmen Square uprisings have just roiled the country in the last few weeks. Nearly 3 years into the pandemic, China still locks down parts of major cities and forces people into quarantine centers when they get sick. From a disease control perspective, that's worked. Compared to the United States, where more than a million people have died, China has seen only around 5,000 deaths. But if China does move away from zero COVID, what could that look like in a country of more than a billion people? For more on that, we have now Dr. Peter Chin Hong, infectious disease specialist at UCSF. Welcome back to Press Play.
Thanks for having me on, Madeline.
Well, so you have this problem. On the one hand, these policies have really helped China avoid a catastrophe, the kind that we've seen here in the U.S. On the other hand, though, as many health officials say, this disease is likely here to stay. And now you have this country, which is the most populous in the world, without much natural immunity. So from a healthcare perspective, what do you make of this zero COVID policy?
Well, right now, Madeline, I think I am, and a lot of my fellow colleagues are increasingly more worried for China as able to really continue to contain this virus. Times have changed. I think in the beginning, it was easy to rely on one strategy, which they've continued to rely on mainly, which is contact tracing and a little bit of vaccines, although people would say that some of the many of the resources have been misallocated and really singularly focused on one strategy. And as we know with COVID, and certainly in these different times with Omicron, you require multiple strategies. You can't put all of your strategies in one basket, which is why I think I'm worried that this is kind of like a forest, a dry forest, and you're just waiting to light that match of Omicron and not enough beds or vaccines in the elderly.
Yeah. Well, I have seen one estimate that says if zero COVID is lifted, up to 280 million people could get infected and up to 2 million or more people could die.
Yes. And it's not just a matter of not having had enough vaccines. It's the kind of vaccines that they've had, which are probably arguably not as effective, which are Sinopharm or Sinovac versus the mRNA vaccines we've had in the US and many parts of the world. It's the fact that the most vulnerable individuals, the seniors, are not vaccinated, not only because there was any lack of trying, but because there's also been misinformation there. And we've seen that happen in Hong Kong, which in many senses was a dress rehearsal for what might happen in China. And finally, they just don't have enough beds. If you think about ICU beds in China, it's about 3.5 per 100,000 people. In the US, other countries, we're above 10 per 100,000 people.
Wow. So I guess to prepare for this, if they do decide to lift or ease some of these restrictions, they would need to vaccinate primarily, or at least at first, their seniors and do that.
Yes.
How big a lift is that?
That is a huge lift. And again, you're not only talking about the vast numbers. You're talking about the kind of vaccine you're using. And you're talking about, just like we are in the United States and other parts of the world, combating misinformation. There's been a lot of negative, frankly, disinformation about what vaccines are and what they aren't, even in places like China. And certainly that was the reason why there were so many deaths in Hong Kong in January of 2022 when Omicron came through Hong Kong.
Mm. So they don't allow the Moderna or Pfizer vaccines into the country?
No, they haven't. They've relied mainly on local vaccines, which have been used in many parts of the world as well. But what China doesn't have, as you pointed out, is waves of natural infection as well to bolster whatever vaccines are being used in the background.
What about antivirals like Paxlovid? Do they have those?
They have access to antivirals, but again, not probably to be implemented on a wide enough scale easily, as we've seen it here. And again, antivirals are only as good as, I guess they have prioritized diagnosis. So you have to have that diagnosis before giving the antiviral. And again, it probably wouldn't be enough to contain this combustion that might happen.
I understand they have a nasal vaccine that's in a late stage trial there that could be something that could stop the spread of the virus. What do you know about that?
Well, the nasal vaccine will probably be only, it's kind of like a Jamba Boost for the Jamba smoothie. It's probably not going to give you the biggest bang for the buck. And again, if you're not going to even take the regular vaccine in the senior population, I think they'd have to really go against, again, misinformation with trying to implement a new strategy like a nasal vaccine. And again, what we're talking about is something that needs to be implemented right now. And I think there's still too much time that would be taken to build this up to full capacity to really implement it.
So I understand you are talking to some doctors in the country. What are they telling you?
I think what's more important to me is what they're not telling me. I think there's probably been people have been a little bit more hesitant in really saying how things were on the ground. In the beginning of the pandemic, we were in really constant communication, and it's fallen off a little bit. Of course, I would say, speaking for Hong Kong, where there's a lot of interaction with Hong Kong scientists and U.S. scientists, particularly around SARS and now SARS-CoV-2, they're kind of worried. Certainly, when the big number of deaths, large number of deaths in seniors occurred in Hong Kong in January. People were really beside themselves and I think fearing for the worst.
Mm. Do you anticipate that Chinese authorities, given what's happening politically, might just accept a large proportion of senior deaths?
I think they wouldn't want to do that. I mean, one part of Chinese culture, again, is saving face. And if you look at the strategies of the Chinese government, not only in China, but in other countries that are imbued with this culture, the last thing you want to do is save face. So you're going to hold on to this control as much as possible, even from a disease perspective. But I think, you know, Jiang Zemin, who was the president of China a few years ago and who died in the last day or so, people are worried that that's going to, again, combust a whole round of protests because, again, he stood for opening up China at the time. And this is like the opposite of opening up China.
Well, thank you very much for joining us again.
Thanks so much, Madeline.
That's Dr. Peter Chin Hong, infectious disease specialist at UC San Francisco. Coming up, that weird media tour of disgraced FTX CEO Sam Bankman-Fried and what his company's bankruptcy says about the future of crypto. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand.
I mean, look, I've had a bad month. This has not been a fun month for me.
Sam Bankman-Fried, the disgraced founder and now former CEO of the cryptocurrency exchange FTX, which is now in bankruptcy. Quite the understatement yesterday in that wide-ranging hour-long discussion with the New York Times. For what it's worth, Bankman-Fried, known by his initials SBF, was speaking from the Bahamas. He was apologetic but evasive in his conversation with The Times' Andrew Ross Sorkin.
Were you truthful with us today?
I was as truthful as I'm knowledgeable to be. There's some things I wish I knew more about.
Okay. Going against the advice of his lawyers, SBF has been on a bit of a media tour. He also spoke to Good Morning America and Axios. We're going to talk about what we're learning from his media blitz and what the collapse of FTX means for cryptocurrency in general with Emily Stewart. She covers business and economics for Vox. Hi.
Hi, how's it going?
Great, thanks. Okay, I want to play one more clip from that interview. It's a little irresistible with Andrew Ross Sorkin, who was really direct with Sam Bankman-Fried when he asked him about what's at the core of this scandal, really. And that's the overlap between FTX and its trading arm, Alameda Research.
But just make this very straight. Was there commingling of funds? That's what it appears like. It appears like there's been a genuine commingling of the funds that are of FTX customers that were not supposed to be commingled with your separate firm.
I didn't knowingly commingle funds. And again, one piece of this, you have the margin trading. You have, you know, customers borrowing from each other. Alameda is one of those. I was frankly surprised by how big Alameda's position was, which points to another failure of oversight on my part and failure to appoint someone to be chiefly in charge of that. But I wasn't trying to commingle funds.
Okay, translate that for us. What is he talking about?
So basically what it seems like happened, what all of the reporting says has happened, is that let's say I invested money through FTX and I give them my money. And I suppose that FTX is keeping my money somewhere. But what it seems like is happening is that FTX was giving that money in one way or another over to Alameda, this trading arm, this hedge fund that Sam Bankman-Fried has been involved with since 2017 that he started then, and that they presumably lost the money, or we don't know what happened to the money, but full stop, customer funds seem to have been used for something that they probably shouldn't have been.
Okay, here's another clip of tape of him being asked pretty much the same thing from George Stephanopoulos on today's Good Morning America.
Alameda is borrowing the money that belongs to FTX depositors, that's a bright red line, isn't it?
There are a lot of cases where that's actually explicitly part of the programs and that are
but
happening.
Not here. Here it says that the digital assets may not be loaned to FTX trading. They can't be loaned out.
There existed a borrow lending facility on FTX. And I think that's probably covered, I don't remember exactly where, but somewhere else in the terms of service.
Okay, he's super evasive in both of these interviews about this core issue. And I guess I'm wondering if, for one, well, I'm wondering a lot of things. One, is he lying? But number two is, why did he agree to these interviews?
I mean, number two, I think is a big question everyone is asking, assuming his lawyers as well are asking these questions. In terms of whether or not he's lying, I mean, it's certain that he's being pretty evasive, right? It sounds like he's trying to act like Alameda was another customer of his, which is just not the case. We know that at some points they all lived together, Alameda and the FTX people, that he founded Alameda and then went on to found FTX. I spoke with him in an interview a year and a half ago, and I remember asking him, wait, so they're separate. And he said kind of like, yes, but no. And he seems to kind of want to say, I didn't know what was going on, but also I'm sorry. But at the same time, you kind of have to ask yourself, if you didn't know what was going on, like who was doing this? These things weren't magically happening.
And even the former CEO of Alameda, Carolyn Ellison, said he knew about that. He knew about the funds being used to pay Alameda's creditors.
Right. Well, assuming that he is CEO of FTX, how would you not know that funds were just disappearing from your exchange? It just doesn't make sense. And yes, Caroline has said that as well.
Yeah. And so the importance of this is for the people who invested that many of them lost a lot of money, some their life savings.
Right. I mean, I think that's sort of the underlying thing here and something that we don't talk about enough in crypto is we talk about, right, the amount of your Bitcoin can go up or down and what's happened with a lot of customers on FTX, including, it looks like at least for now, FTX US, is that whatever money you put in is just poof, gone. And we don't talk about that a lot. And that's happened with other exchanges as well. But when you give these exchanges your money, it might not be there anymore. And there are a lot of people, you know, not as many in the United States, but really around the globe, where their deposits with FTX are just gone. And it's not clear if they're ever going to see anything or pennies on the dollar of what they put in.
Hmm. Meanwhile, another crypto company associated with FTX failed this week. So what is the future of this entire business?
I mean, this is certainly a dark cloud over the business. I think one thing to say here is that crypto has had multiple collapses. We've seen multiple cycles of this. Crypto kind of seems to keep coming back. There's definitely contagion. I think it's very likely that a lot of companies that were part of this current boom cycle are not going to survive. Whether or not the entire industry dies, it's hard to say. It certainly hasn't died yet, despite plenty of troubles over the past 10 years or so.
But maybe Congress and other regulatory bodies are deciding now how to regulate it more, right? And make sure that this doesn't happen again.
Right. I mean, that's the hope. I think the question is what those regulations would even look like. You know, I've talked to one expert in this who said if you give crypto special regulations, there's a chance that it could become more entrenched in the financial system. And the question is, do we want this? Like, obviously, what has happened with FTX is awful for customers, but it's also worth noting that it hasn't infected the broader financial system. And that's good for the rest of us who were not involved in this.
But for the people who were, too bad for them. They won't ever be able to recover their money.
It is really tough. It's really tough. It's really risky. And I think it's something that, you know, it's hard to say this should be lessened because that's not at all what I'd want to say here. But it's just crypto is really risky. And this is a really tough situation for a lot of people who really are not going to see their money again.
Emily Stewart covers business and economics. She's been writing about cryptocurrency for Vox. Emily, thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, we will have your weekend movie reviews, including a drama called Return to Seoul.
This is Cambodia's Oscar entry this year. It stars Park Ji-min. This is her first film role, and she is fantastic.
Movie reviews next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Happy Thursday. Time for film reviews. Alonzo Duralde is here, chief film critic for The Wrap and co-host of the movie podcast Linoleum Knife. Welcome back.
Hello.
Hello. And also joining us is Katie Walsh. She reviews films for the Tribune News Service, the Los Angeles Times, and The Wrap. Hi, Katie.
Hi, Madeline.
All right. An auspicious pair. An unusual pair.
I'm excited to be here.
But a good pair. First,
Dave White sends his regards.
And regards back at you, Dave. First up, we have a holiday dark comedy. It stars David Harbour from Stranger Things as Santa. And this one is called Violent Night.
You ain't driving, are you?
I steer a little, but the reindeer do most of the work.
This is my fourth year as a Santa. How about you?
I started the whole damn thing. We decided that you could have one gift.
Early.
What is it?
That is a direct hotline to Santa Claus himself.
I can talk to Santa.
All right, revelers. Welcome to your worst Christmas ever.
Let's go!
Okay, that's John Leguizamo starring as the leader of mercenaries trying to kidnap a wealthy family. And it's a good thing, Alonzo, that Santa is there because he is really, he's moonlighting as Bruce Willis.
Yeah, this is a movie designed to end the "is Die Hard really a Christmas movie" argument once and for all, I think. This is a hard R violent action comedy, but it also accommodates a subplot about a little girl's belief in Santa Claus. And those are two things that should not fit together. And believe me, as somebody who is as much of a Christmas movie expert as anybody, I've seen a lot of Santa movies that go way off the rails. And so for all the things that this could have gotten wrong, Violent Night pretty much does it all right. It's funny. The action is exciting. The performances are terrific. David Harbour and John Leguizamo, but also Beverly D'Angelo, Christmas movie royalty, and Cam Gigandet, and Edie Patterson. And so, yeah, I had a blast at this movie, and it is not for all tastes, and certainly not for people who think that, you know, that Christmas movies should not have bone-spurting action. But I think it's a hoot.
A hoot. Okay. So, and you are the expert, we have to say, on Christmas movies.
Thank you.
You've written a book on it. And we're going to talk to you later about Christmas movies on another show. But anyway,
excellent.
Katie, what did you think?
Yeah, my hot cocoa is a little bit cooler on Violent Night. I think it's amusing enough. I think my issue with the film is that you can kind of see the gears cranking. Like, it's very Die Hard meets Home Alone. Mm-hmm. And you can kind of just see the filmmakers like doing the math in order to like make all of that work together. Yeah. I do think that there is no one else in Hollywood who could have pulled this off like David Harbour. And I think he's great opposite John Leguizamo, especially. It's so strange. Like Alonzo mentioned, it is like so violent. It uses every Christmas pun in the books that they could possibly think of and to make, you know, a swear or, you know, foul mouthed or a threat in some way. But it does also manage to get that heartwarming, you know, Christmas spirit in this, you know, very dark, bloody action film. So they managed to pull it off. But yeah, I think it's like fun, but I don't know if it has that much staying power for me.
Is this something you do not take the kids to?
No, absolutely not.
Oh, for sure.
Oh, okay. Good. All right. Violent Night, not for the children, is in theaters in wide release beginning today. Next up, Return to Seoul, written and directed by Davy Zhu. It follows Freddie. She's a 25-year-old French adoptee who goes to South Korea to find her biological family.
My name, Siwan.
감사합니다.
Where are you from?
France.
All right, Katie, tell us more about the plot of this film.
Yeah, Return to Seoul. Davy Ju is a French-Cambodian filmmaker, and this is Cambodia's Oscar entry this year, actually, but it takes place entirely in Seoul, and it stars Park Ji-min. This is her first film role, and she is fantastic playing Freddie, who is this woman who sort of accidentally ends up in Seoul, and she realizes she is on this search for her parents and for her identity in Seoul. We kind of follow her over the course of about 10 years as she is coming back to Seoul. So we see her as a young 20-something, kind of wild and free and reckless. And then we see her as more of a career person, but still with these self-destructive tendencies. And then as she starts to, you know, go through this process of like reckoning with her identity and healing and finding herself. So it's this constant search for identity, both through the lens of being an adoptee who has a French identity. And she keeps saying, you know, I'm French. But through the process of just finding yourself in your 20s and 30s and making bad choices and then trying to correct them. And it's a really fantastic film. It is so stylish. It looks amazing. Park Ji-min is so cool. She is like, she's a cool girl who is also so heartbreaking in moments. And the soundtrack's amazing. It just feels like a film that they don't make them like this very often anymore. And it's just like, it's just a really fantastic blend of cultures with a really personal and sort of heartrending story at the center of it that I think anybody can relate to, you know, just about trying to find yourself. Mm-hmm. So it's a wonderful film. It's so good.
Great. Okay, Alonzo, this premiered at Cannes this year. What did you think?
Yeah, no, it's terrific. Interesting. I've been doing my sort of year-end catch-up on everything, and so I watched it almost back-to-back with Charlotte Wells's After Sun, which is kind of also a movie about a young woman trying to sort of reckon with her parentage. Yeah, Park Ji-min's performance is extraordinary, and the things that she does to sort of differentiate, you know, a young woman in her mid-20s versus a young woman in her early 30s, just the way she sort of holds her face, little tiny responses just indicate so much in a way that isn't actory or like, oh, I, you know, changed my makeup or whatever. She's a really exciting discovery. And the film, yeah, absolutely kind of, you know, it's one of those movies that really pulls you into the heart of a character and doesn't underline and italicize everything for you, but you see these experiences through her eyes and you understand the impact that it's having on her. And it does call into question so many interesting things about, you know, who are we as people if we are raised somewhere that isn't, you know, where we were born or, you know, where maybe the other place, you know, we stand out in a racial or ethnic way that we wouldn't have if we had, you know, remained in the place of our birth. So it's a very global film in that sense. So, yeah, I very much recommend it.
Sounds great. All right. Return to Seoul. It's playing at the Lemley Royal beginning tomorrow. Moving on to a movie called Spoiler Alert, starring Jim Parsons and Ben Aldridge. It's based on the memoir, Spoiler Alert, The Hero Dies, by journalist Michael Osiello.
Slam.
I am.
Let's just take a moment to appreciate this beauty.
Kit, what is going on? Are you all right?
Come down off the ledge, Mike. I'm seeing a doctor tomorrow.
I'm afraid the news isn't good. Forever, forever,
if we're not together. I was always afraid Kit would break my heart, and eventually he did. He broke it open.
All right, Alonzo, this is based on Michael Osiello's account of the last 11 months of his partner, Kit Cowan's, life after he was diagnosed with, spoiler alert, terminal cancer. Sally Field is also in this. What did you think?
Yeah, this one is it's a toughie because, you know, this is a true story, and it's about Michael Osiello. I've not read this memoir, but I've been a fan of his TV journalism work for years. But the way that this movie is put forth, it's directed by Michael Showalter, and I was not the biggest fan of The Big Sick, but I get why people liked it. And he seemed to be like, okay, I need another kind of funny movie, but where there's also disease and, you know, some tragedy thrown in. And the mix just doesn't work here. And I think a lot of it has to do with Jim Parsons' performance as Michael Osiello. He creates such a collection of like tics and neuroses that I never believed him as a human being. And he's playing a real guy. And so that kind of kept me at a distance throughout. And the relationship with Kit, as played by Ben Aldridge, never unfolds in a way that you sort of understand what brings these guys together, what keeps them together, what drives them apart, what brings them back together when Kit gets ill, which are sort of the essential building blocks of a story like this. And so you're just kind of left with a lot of, I don't know, just outsider commentary that never gets into it. It's the kind of movie where like they're each assigned one best friend who shows up for every major moment in their lives. And there's some hair and makeup choices that happen to Jim Parsons that are very distracting. So yeah, this movie didn't work for me. Mm.
Yeah, it does sound very treacly listening to the trailer. Katie, what did you think?
Yeah, it's very treacly. And I agree with Alonzo that the relationship doesn't quite gel. One of the things that they do, which I assume is from Osiello's memoir, is like, you know, because he is a TV journalist, they kind of use these TV tropes in order to illustrate like how he copes with these hard feelings through his work or through his love of television. So when we flash back to his childhood, it's shot like a 90s sitcom. And there's like one moment where they kind of break the device and he like starts interviewing characters on screen as if he's a TV journalist, you know, interviewing characters in a TV show. And I almost wish they had like leaned more into that. Like it's kind of like halfway. Mm. I mean, listen, I did sob my eyes out at this movie. And I do think that Ben Aldridge is fantastic. And this is really like a breakout role for him. And Sally Field, it was like the combination of Sally Field and Ben Aldridge, like got the tears flowing for me. Yeah, I'm mixed on it as well, but you will cry.
Okay. Spoiler alert in select theaters beginning today. Last up, we have Four Samosas. This follows a wannabe rapper who conspires with three friends to steal from a grocery store owned by his ex-girlfriend's father.
We were meant to be together.
I got tired of waiting for you.
That makes no sense.
Life makes no sense. But still, we persist.
You want to do what?
Reappropriate the wealth.
You know how he really makes his money, right? He smuggles dirty diamonds.
So you want to steal his stuff?
I'm in.
Okay, Katie, Vinny is the wannabe rapper at the center of this, and he wants to steal wedding diamonds from his ex's family so he can stop her from marrying someone else. What did you think?
Yeah, this is a really cute movie that's very much in the vein of like 90s indie movies like Clerks or Bottle Rocket. It really has that sort of 90s throwback appeal. It's written and directed by Ravi Kapoor, who has a very small role in this. But I think this film really belongs to the star, Venk Petula, who plays Vinny. He's super charming. He holds the whole thing together. It's got kind of a dry, sort of ironic tone to it a little bit, but it's also this big ensemble comedy where he's got to get his friends together and sort of get his community together to kind of do this heist, this really misguided heist. And, you know, at the end, it's like, you know, it wasn't the destination. It was the journey. You know, we made friends along the way. So it's not really breaking any molds in that sense. Also, it takes place in Artesia, which is just south of LA, Little India. And it definitely made me want to go to Artesia and kind of explore that neighborhood and maybe get some samosas.
Yeah, okay, maybe four samosas. Alonzo.
Four, exactly.
Alonzo, what did you think?
Yeah, I think Katie nails it. It very much feels like, you know, the sort of spawn of Kevin Smith and Wes Anderson's early work. But, you know, spotlighting this really terrific ensemble of folks, you know, you might remember Venk Petula from Veep, you know, Summer Bashil from Towelhead. And of course, Karan Soni, you know, steals every scene that he's in. It has a bright, you know, very L.A. movie kind of look to it. And the costumes are colorful. And, you know, it's the kind of movie where they don't footnote anything for non-Indian American viewers. So they talk about very kind of culturally specific historical things and food and music and whatever else. And, you know, where it's up to us to keep up with it. I think there are no white speaking roles in the film. And so, you know, it is very much immersed in this community. And it's fun in that regard. It is slight, you know, it has an 80-minute running time and it is comprised of like plot elements you have seen, you know, many times before, but as kind of a showcase for these really talented performers, you know, it's a nice lark.
Does it end in a wedding?
I won't tell.
Don't all of these kind of movies end in a wedding?
You know what? It ends in another way that is very like these kinds of movies end.
Yes.
Gotcha. All right. Now I'm hungry. So that's just a side note. All right. Thank you both so much. Have a great weekend.
You too.
Thanks, Madeline.
Alonzo Duralde, chief film critic for The Wrap and co-host of the movie podcast Linoleum Knife, and Katie Walsh reviews films for the Tribune News Service, the Los Angeles Times, and also The Wrap. And that's a wrap.
KCRW sponsors include Searchlight Pictures, presenting Empire of Light, the new film by Sam Mendes, starring Olivia Colman, Michael Ward, and Colin Firth, about the power of human connection during a time of great change, in select theaters December 9th.
Coming up, Evan Kleiman is here to tell us all about eating and cooking with pomegranates. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand.
Bon appetit.
Where's the lamb sauce?
Salty, sweet, and oaky nuttiness.
15-minute bake-off, Queens.
And then we add the whiskey. Boom! Flames.
Bam! That's a little bad like that.
Pie.
Well, guess what? It's pomegranate season. You may have noticed these ruby red antioxidant-packed fruits in the grocery store. And then you scratch your head and wonder, what can I do with these things? Well, here to the rescue is Evan Kleiman, host of KCRW's Good Food. Hello.
Hello.
I look at them and I think, wow, it'd be great to use pomegranates in something like a salad. And then I think of removing them from the flesh and I say, no thanks, and head straight for the apples.
Oh my gosh, you know, I'm addicted to fresh pomegranates. And when they're in season, I probably eat one a day.
One a day? Okay.
They're so, and they're wonderful if you keep them in the refrigerator so they're a bit chilled. Uh-huh. Yeah, when I have the desire to munch, if I don't do popcorn, I'm doing pomegranate. And it's just so perfect to graze on out of the whole fruit, because once you understand how to cut them or open them up, then they're very easy and it isn't that big a mess.
Okay, so we're going to get to that in a minute. First, though, tell us where they came from. Where does the pomegranate come from?
It is pretty sure that they originated in Persia, but not the country of Iran, the expansive Persian Empire, which means that it's native from Iran to the Himalayas in northern India, and it's been cultivated since ancient times. It came to California pretty early in 1769, brought, of course, by Spanish settlers. So after being here for a few hundred years, we can say it's ours as well.
Yeah, I think so. I think we can lay claim. So you eat the pomegranate seeds when you're grazing and snacking, but you also drink it, right? Drink the juice?
Yeah, I was taught how to do this really fun thing, which can result in disaster if you're not careful, and that is to crush the seeds or the arils through the skin. So you're basically pressing against the skin to break all the seeds. You can also just roll them on a counter, and then you end up with this kind of leathery bag of juice. And you can either cut a little slit and stick a straw in and drink it, or you can just bite into it and let the juice just gush into your mouth.
The leathery bag of juice is the pomegranate.
Right. It's the whole pomegranate.
But you're saying you can just roll the fruit on the counter, loosen it up, and then stick a straw in it?
Yeah. But really biting into it and sucking it out is just, it's a very satisfying experience.
Sounds very.
I always wear something I don't care about just in case it doesn't turn out well. And we are going to make a video of me doing it, which could be fabulous or hilariously funny, depending on how things go.
Okay. Well, definitely stay tuned for that. In the meantime, if I just want to eat the seeds, how do I de-seed a pomegranate?
You cut the top off around the little crown, the blossom end, And you pull that off, and then you peer into it, and you see that the way the membranes are, the white pith is aligned with the bumps that are on the pomegranate. And at the apex of each of these little sides, you take a sharp knife and you shallowly cut a slit from top to bottom. And then you just pull it open. And when you pull it open, you end up with the seeds just exposed. There might be one or two places where there's still a little bit of the white covering, but I just pull them off. I mean, you don't have to bang it. I don't have good luck cutting them in half horizontally and then banging them over a bowl. Mm-hmm. I find that they much more messy.
Yeah. I see. So you kind of score it and then
that's
pull
the word.
It apart.
Yeah, you score it and then you pull it apart and then you just carefully reach in and you just pull them off into a bowl.
And if you're not going to just eat them right then and there, what do you put them in?
Well, I mean, the thing about pomegranate arils that's so amazing is this is a garnish that actually gives you incredible flavor. It's that sweet and sour play on taste that pomegranates have. Mm-hmm. They're really fantastic in any winter salad, you know, like a salad of fennel and celery root, for example. I also really love how they take something incredibly simple and make an amazing relish. So you can slice up an onion, rub it with a bit of salt, and then just add some pomegranate seeds to it. And it's wonderful as a little relish for meat or fish. But what I really love to do, if you're talking about cooking with pomegranates, then Persian dishes, the Persian stews are just fabulous. The most famous one being fesanjan, which is, it's a stew typically made with poultry and either pomegranate juice or pomegranate molasses that's been diluted with some water and walnuts. And the combination of the red of the pomegranate juice and the brown of the walnuts after cooking for a while turns the stew into just this deep mahogany color. And it is just, it's unique. There's no other flavor that has the flavor of this stew. And I asked the queen of Persian cooking in America, Najmieh Batmanglij, if she would share a couple recipes with us. And she was kind enough to send me a vegetarian version of fesanjan and also this marvelous recipe for a pistachio and pomegranate meatball, which you can also make vegetarian. It's so beautiful.
Mmm, that sounds really good. So I imagine so you put a bunch of pistachios in a Cuisinart and get a paste and mush it all up.
Yeah, and you're also using meat if you like. If you don't, and you can use any kind of meat or fish. And if you want it to be vegetarian, then your base is quinoa. And it has all kinds of herbs. And I mean, Persian food is so complex. But once you make one or two dishes, they become a part of your repertoire.
There's also a dish called muhammara. What is that?
Muhammara is paste. It's like a loose paste. You might think of it like a hummus. It's made of roasted peppers is the main ingredient, roasted red peppers. And then ground up crackers are used to kind of thicken it with a little bit of garlic and pomegranate molasses. And it's really fantastic tasting because of the pomegranate molasses. It just gives that zip to the peppers.
Where do you get pomegranate molasses?
There are a couple different brands. Some are sweeter than others. Some brands will actually say sour on it, and they're made with less sugar. But once you have a bottle of pomegranate molasses in your house, it's incredible if you're making like a bulgur pilaf to just add as a drizzle. It's fantastic in cocktails. It's just an all-around incredible ingredient.
As is the pomegranate.
Oh, I'm so excited that I'm in pomegranate season now.
Well, you can check out these recipes. They're at kcrw.com. And also, videos will be up of you drinking the pomegranate itself and de-seeding one. That's at KCRW on Instagram, also KCRW.com. Evan Kleiman hosts KCRW's Good Food, which you can hear on KCRW Saturdays at 10. And you can also get it wherever you get your podcasts. Evan, thank you.
Thank you.
And that does it for this week on Press Play. Our producers are Brian Hardzinski, Angie Perrin, Bennett Purser, and Marcel Hutchins. Michelle Aloy is our line editor. Amy Taw is our digital editor. Sarah Sweeney is our managing producer. And our technical director is the ever super Mario Saavedra. Don't forget, you can follow us on Twitter and Instagram. We're at KCW Press Play. You can also download our podcast wherever you get your podcasts if you want to hear this show over and over and over again. You can do that. I'm Madeline Brand. Thanks for listening, and I will see you on Monday.